It's time to get nerdy, y'all.
A little bit of gaming history for you.
Something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it.
Should we kick it out of here or should we kickstart it?
This is the part where you, the listeners, try to stump the hosts.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's Tuesday, June 22nd, 2021, and you know what that means. It's time to get nerdy, y'all. Welcome to episode number 192 of Two Nerds in a Pod, the nerdiest video game podcast in the galaxy. I am Lom, also known as Mr. Nice Guy, and I'm joined by my comrade in gaming commentary, the Miggity 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 Mac, also known as Maction. Mac, how was your week, buddy?
My week was terrific. Now, it had some unfortunateness in that there were a lot of things that I wanted to happen that didn't happen. Like, I had a thing that didn't really go the way I expected, and then we didn't game on Thursday, and then there was just all these things, but...
Dude, you're always so vague. You had a thing that didn't go the way you were expecting. Come on.
Well, okay, sure. My birthday was very lonely last week.
Why didn't you say something?
Well, I did in my own way, but I just, it was very lonely because I'm used to getting together with people, you know? And last year I was very much just like, oh man, well, you know, there's a pandemic on, so, but this year didn't really seem to have quite the same thing. So it was just that sort of thing where I really missed having a get together, you know, spitting on a dessert and then having us all eat a part of the dessert that I spat upon.
Yeah, yeah. It's a ritual.
Yeah, it's a ritual, and I kind of missed it. But I'm doing good. This weekend had a fun thing. Did a crossover episode with Video Game Crosstalk. It was just the two of us, and so that was fun. And yeah, got a lot of stuff done. I've been reading some good things. It was all right.
Dude, speaking of reading good things, I gotta hold this up.
Is it The Invincible? Did it finally come?
It came a while ago, and I've been reading it slowly, enjoying it like, I don't know, something that you enjoy slowly, like a food that you want to savor. It's a really, really good book. And I know we usually save that kind of stuff for what we've been watching and playing. But if you haven't watched Invincible on Amazon Prime, and you're watching our show, there's like a Venn diagram that would show that the people who like our show would also like Invincible. So You should go watch it. But I mean, other than that, life is good, man. We're getting all settled into the new place. And I have pretty much no complaints. Well, Mac, on that note, I say we do what we do best and hop right into that gaming news, man. What do you think about that?
Let's do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is episode number 192 of Two Nerds in a Pod, nerdiest video game podcast in the galaxy. A few news stories this week. Here's the thing, Mac. Every single news site was packed with deals for Amazon Prime Day. So there wasn't a lot of gaming news. Like, everything was like, you can get AirPods. You can get Returnal for PS5. You know, you can get PS Plus for cheap. So on that note, I know you're like anti-big corporation, but did you get anything on Amazon Prime? Did you get yourself an external hard drive? Did you get yourself some Mega Man socks?
Nope. Were Mega Man socks an option?
No, because I would have bought them for you if they were.
You know me so well. No, I haven't picked up anything on Amazon. I don't expect to pick up anything on Amazon in the next little while. Although I am excited to hear about the deals.
Yeah, so I wasn't even going to go over them simply because by the time people hear them in this recording, they will be over. But you know what, Mac? For the people who are here live, and the people who are here live that don't know how to Google, I'll go over a few of the deals. I will go over a few of the best video game deals as I scroll down this gaming website and search for them, unprepared to do my own show.
You gotta expect the unexpected, and here I come just screwing things up.
No, you're good. So here they are. These are the ones that end at midnight. These are listed on IGN.com. So Xbox Series S, not a deal, but it has been in stock on Amazon. So if you're looking for an Xbox Series X, check Amazon.com. You might get lucky. You can get 3 months of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate for 33% off, $29.99, which is a killer deal unless you're Maction. Ghost of Tsushima, $29.99 for PS4, phenomenal game. Returnal PS5, $49.99, usually about $70. Same thing with Demon's Souls, $49.94. Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening, $39.88. Mac, where would you put Link's Awakening in your ranking of Zeldas? It's one of my top three.
Link's Awakening is pretty darn good. I would certainly put it in the top 10. And I maybe the top 5. The problem is there are some Zeldas that I still haven't played, including the ones on this on the Philips CDI, so I can't give a full accounting.
You know perfectly well. You know full well that those are not going to be in the top ranking.
I mean, I don't know for sure until I've tried them. They might have a certain, as the French would say, I don't know what.
Je ne sais quoi?
No, I'm pretty sure it's I don't know what.
Last of Us Part 2, $29.99. And if you haven't played that yet, it's been a year. What are you even doing? Unless you're not a PS4 person. So, lots of good gaming deals. The Game Pass Ultimate is one that I think almost anyone who's a gamer could benefit from. If you have a PC or if you have an Xbox, it's a pretty dang solid deal. And that's some of the top ones. We're not going to go over the Apple stuff because Maxion would kill me. So, moving on to other news stuff. Mac, Pokemon Go was a game that really required you to get out and do stuff. And I'm curious from our people in the chat, how many of you played Pokemon Go and are looking forward to getting back into it? Because now they're preparing to roll back pandemic-related changes. This is on IGN.com by Rebecca Valentine. Niantic is gearing up to start rolling back some changes it's made over the last year to Pokemon Go that made it more viable to play during the pandemic-related lockdowns, though it's committed to keeping at least some of those changes in the game permanently. In a blog post today, the developer announced that it would begin rolling out changes designed to return it to its original focus of exploration, exercise, and playing with friends. The shifts will start after Pokemon Go Fest in the US and New Zealand, where areas are beginning to open back up fully, and will slowly be rolled out globally as they make sense. So, Mac, a couple questions. One, are you ever going to get back into this game? And two, are we starting to open up the world too quickly? What do you think, man?
Oh, wow. I'll tackle the video game-related one first. And then I'll tackle the subjective slash moral slash, I'll put on my pandemic response hat for that one. Maybe, probably not. I feel like it's one of those things where I'm just too far behind to really catch up. Maybe I could potentially try it out someday, but for the most part, I think maybe the ship has sailed for me. Old man Mac can't keep up with the kids these days. As for opening up too quickly, gosh, I don't know.
That's not even a gaming-related question. I literally just threw that out there to mess with you, man.
No, I appreciate it. I mean, my feeling in general is that I want to be surrounded by more people than I have been lately, so I very much would like some eased restrictions. At the same time, though, I certainly want everybody to be safe, so...
Yeah, I'm the same way. And I'm not going to get back into Pokemon Go. Like, it was fun. It was just a cool premise when it came out. You know what I mean? But it's not something that, to me, had a lot of replayability to the point that I would make it one of my go-tos. I honestly didn't even realize they had made pandemic-related changes. So that's just me. But speaking of the world opening back up, Mac, this is a big one. This is on GameInformer.com by Leanna Rupert. Also related to stuff opening back up in the gaming world. With vaccinations continuing to roll out, PAX West 2021 will be among the gaming events returning to offer in-person community celebrations. Not only will the event be returning in a more familiar form outside of a digital alternative, but ReadPop has also detailed safety precautions that are being implemented for those planning on attending. I want to know from the chat, comfort levels with attending in-person gaming events now that the world is opening back up, now that people are vaccinated. Mac, it goes on to say PAX West 2021 will be returning to the Washington State Convention Center in Seattle, Washington from Friday, September 3rd through Monday, September 6th. Badges are going on sale soon. So PAX has been gone for almost 2 years. PAX West has. It's opening back up. Like, as someone who, you know, we've done those types of conventions in the past, where's your comfort level with doing them again?
Well, man, I would certainly enjoy going back to them again. My comfort level is I've always been willing to risk the crowds and enjoy the energy and realize that I'm probably going to get sick and be ready and willing to take some time off of work in addition to the time to go to a thing, and I think people need to be realistic about that and know that going in.
Yeah, and I don't know, my thing is, like, and I even was trying to set up an interview with someone who owns it, like an arcade, I won't say who it was, and I wanted to do the interview about, you know, what it's like post-pandemic. Because for me, I mean, I'm vaccinated, right? But I just don't know how I feel going forward about going and doing activities where everyone is touching the same controllers, right? And everyone is touching the same games. I mean, back in the day, people used to do that and then just, like, eat food right afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the people who were carrying around hand sanitizer, like, pre-coronavirus were almost seen as, like, germaphobes and a little bit weird. I was definitely someone who washed my hands, but, like, at a gaming convention, you know, we were all using the same demo stations. We were all high-fiving. I mean, it, like, it's just a totally different thing. Now, as far as my comfort level of attending something like this, I feel fine with it. But I definitely will be interested to see how they handle the use of controllers, the use of long lines, you know, all that stuff. I think it might be different.
You know, I say we go and let's build some backpacks with dispensing stations on it. You know, we bring a bunch of alcohol wipes and build some Purell dispensers into the back and carry that around with us. I think we'd be the toast of the town.
I don't think Purell dispensers are going anywhere. Like, I think that those sanitizing stations are going to be around for a long time. Even, like, when you go to GameStop now, which who does that? But you get my point. Like, even when you go to a place that just has, like, a game station, you know, or even places that have little touchscreens, like, it's just a totally different world. All right. Anyway, moving on. Last news story of the week. This is one for Galvatron because he is one of our viewers who likes to buy expensive stuff that no one really needs. So this is for you, G. This is on GameSpot.com by Alessandro Barbosa. With monitors now starting to release with HDMI 2.1 support, you might be tempted to investigate options for your new Xbox Series X or S. Microsoft has taken a lot of the guesswork out of the equation with its new Design for Xbox program, bestowing a certification on displays that will play best with its new range of gaming consoles. All of these new displays are coming later this year, but support the important features of HDMI 2.1, including 4K, 120Hz, variable refresh rate, low latency modes, and varying degrees of HDR. $1,600, Mac, for a Philips Momentum 55-inch monitor. You're not a videophile. Are you a videophile, Mac? Do you like, when you're playing a game, do you want it on, like, optimum settings? When you're playing on Chasm, do you want the images to jump out at you? I need to get your perspective on this.
Oh, I don't know. I like my pixels blocky, and 4K can only do so much for those pixels, if I'm honest. You know, it's not really that important to me. I think I've only just recently upgraded my computer monitors to get to that 1080p station. So I feel like I'm at least a couple steps behind with respect to all things video and videophile.
Yeah, and I mean, it ultimately depends what you're playing, right? Because, and I was telling my brother this the other day, because last night we were playing PS5. And I was, 'cause he's in town right now. I don't know if I mentioned that. And I was saying, dude, the only reason this is so awesome is because I have the TV that optimizes the like that works well with the PS5. And I'm not someone who needs the best visuals. But for people to be able to take care of these, or rather take advantage of these next gen consoles, you really do need to make sure that you have a 4K TV with refresh rate and HDR. Now, that said, if you're just playing old school stuff, absolutely don't do it. And also, I don't think there's any reason for a monitor that is 55 inches to cost $1,600 that's specific to Xbox. Just get an OLED TV that you can also use for movies. Don't bite on this Microsoft stuff. That's my opinion.
So now, in a strange turn of events, in spite of the shade that Mr. Nice Guy was throwing at the beginning here toward Galvatron, bringing up a good point live in the chat, the problem with these official, air quotes, monitors is that you're paying for an expensive endorsement. There are just as great cheaper monitors out there whose manufacturers refrained from purchasing a license from Microsoft. And I wonder how much money that license from Microsoft, that stuff, how much it cost and how much it actually factors into the improvement of it to have it be official, air quotes.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's all a game to me. It's all a game to me. Because honestly, if you plug your PlayStation 5 into one of those, I'm pretty sure it would work pretty darn well, right? It's not just for Xbox. It's optimizing Xbox. But that said, I strongly doubt that that monitor works better than an LG OLED TV. So,
yeah.
And that has been our news for the week.
All right. Well, now that we've taken a look at what's going on right now, let's take a look into the past with some video game history. I want to start in 2010. This week, we saw the release of Final Fantasy I for mobile devices. Hey! This proved, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Square Enix did not care about putting effort into their re-releases on mobile devices. As the release, as I've got a bit of bee in my bonnet about it still, but the release for was originally, so what they did is they took the port that they made for, I want to say is like DS, and then they ported it straight over to iOS, and then they ported the iOS port to Android, which was hilarious because, as I'm sure you know, Android devices tended to have different resolutions, whereas iOS devices all had the same exact resolution. So it became painfully obvious when you pulled it up on, like, a tablet, and it filled about 40% of the screen. It was pretty darn bad, and it didn't really improve much over over the time. So yeah,
not
that
optimized
was
optimized for Android.
Yeah, it was a sad day for me. But nonetheless, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about notable things that happened in weeks that this week in years past, and who cares about FF1 on mobile aside from me, obviously. How about one we can all appreciate and enjoy? In 1996, released for the PC, Quake, made by id Software, in the, you know, first person shooter in the style, somewhat similar style of Wolfenstein 3D, which was released in 92, and Doom, that was released in 93. Certainly improving on the Doom style there. You know, you had your health, you had your armor, you had your keys and so on to open doors, you had your levels. I think the thing to highlight where Quake really improved on the formula, though, would have been its multiplayer co-op and multiplayer versus. Obviously, Quake 1, the first in the Quake series, which goes Quake, followed by Quake 2, and then Quake 3 Arena. Now, I'm given to understand, because I didn't play Quake 2 that much, but I'm given to understand that it's kind of a sequel in name only, even though it shares the same kind of genre, but, you know, that's a discussion for another time. Amusingly enough, it turns out that that Quake was a bit of a sticking point between some of the developers when they were actually making the game, to the point that, what's his name, John Romero, right, from id back in those days, he didn't like where they were going with it, and so he left the company as a result of the development of Quake and was like, I'm gonna go do my own thing. And he eventually did get the chance to release what Quake should have been all along. He released a game called Daikatana, which you may have heard of, that somewhat infamous, but that's a story for another time. Quake, I mean, I enjoy the game. I like the aesthetic. I like how it improved on what we saw in Wolfenstein and Doom, and really is this sort of gradual, gradual improvement of the FPS genre. I think the deathmatch aspect of it is really what makes Quake, the versus deathmatch is what makes it really stand out in video game history. I mean, I can see Moocher, of course, is agreeing in the chat here with us live. It had a certain je ne sais quoi, to borrow an English phrase. But Mr. Nice Guy, any strong feelings about Quake by chance?
I just remember it being controversial. Like, I was never a big Quake player, but I remember it was like, it was mentioned in the same vein as Doom, right? As far as, you know, why are you kids doing this, that type of thing. And so I don't have a strong history with Quake, but I just know that it's iconic for that reason. And just as far as how it moved the genre forward, like you said.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit, I didn't have all that many history things. This was a slow week in video game history. And, you know, who wants to release their game in the middle of the year? No. You got to release before Christmas. You know, you got to release after Thanksgiving, before Christmas, so that everybody's buying it. But those are just the two that I wanted to mention today for video game history.
Sweet. Well, slow news week, slow history week, interesting week for topic of the week, and that is the next segment. So, Mac, this is one that I'm sure you have a very, very strong opinion on, as I do. And I know that people in the chat will as well, would love to hear all of your thoughts. This is on Kotaku.com by Ian Walker. Title, VR Players Revolt Against Facebook's In-Game Advertising Plans. Facebook recently ruffled the virtual reality community's feathers when it announced plans to test a new type of in-game advertising in popular Oculus Quest game Blaston. But the blowback's been harsh enough that developer Resolution Games has announced that it is pulling the $10 game from Facebook's ongoing ad test program. After listening to player feedback, we realized that Blaston isn't the best fit for this type of advertising test, Resolution Games explained on Twitter. Therefore, we no longer plan to implement the test. Last week, Facebook revealed that these new virtual reality ads would be displayed in headset, starting with Blaston, a head-to-head dueling game released in 2020. Player response to this announcement was severe and saw the game inundated with negative reviews on both the Oculus Store and Steam. Mac, the reason a lot of people took issue with this is because typically ads are part of free-to-play games, right? You download a mobile game, you don't pay for it. You have to see all these ads. You have to watch a 60-second ad to get more coins. This is a game people were paying for, and Facebook was going to treat it similarly. Are they out of line for this, or are gamers overreacting?
Dude, I'm the wrong person to ask. As we've established through many, many episodes, we're, you know, through the previous 191 episodes, I have extraordinarily unrealistic expectations for video games as compared to the general, you know, I don't have my finger on the pulse, Mr. Nice Guy, as we've shown. I would say absolutely it is ridiculous to expect people to pay. But then again, I also feel that way about paying $80 for a game and then on top of that buying battle passes
now,
and
this,
loot
this
boxes.
Was a $10 game.
I know. I'm just saying, you know, I'm just saying in general, I find a lot of the practices that we have is being silly. But this one definitely. $10 for ads.
I don't know, man. So if I'm playing devil's advocate, right? When you go to a movie, and I know people are going to say this is not the same, but just hear me out. When you go to a movie, there's ads before the movie. And quite frankly, there are ads during the movie, right? You're watching Spider-Man. He's sitting there. He's drinking a Pepsi, right? You see someone carrying a McDonald's bag. You know, there's a character in a movie walking through New York, and there's all kinds of billboards up there for Sony, for whatever. Right? Everything is one big ad. Now, you pay $10 for a movie, you get inundated with ads. What's the difference in paying $10 for a game? And I totally get that it's not the same thing. Because the ad is actually interrupting your experience with the game. But I'm just saying, let's call a spade a spade. We're inundated with ads all the time.
And there are some ads that I have to admit I even quite enjoy. Did you watch the television series Chuck by chance?
I've seen some Chuck. Yeah, I've seen a few episodes.
There was a point in time where their advertising for Subway was hilarious and they hung a lantern on it. And it was delightful. Product placement type of advertisement can be really enjoyable and really great. But I will say that I feel like, and I think I'm going to echo what Moocher has said in the chat, if you pay money, absolutely no ads. Somebody has to pay in some way.
This is such a good topic because what constitutes paying money, right? I pay for cable, I pay for Sling TV, right? Mm-hmm. But when I watch it, there's an understanding that there will be ads. However, when I watch Netflix, there are not ads, right? With Hulu, I pay for Hulu, but unless I pay for the premium version, there are ads. So, like, what is constituting paying me? Like, do we need to have two versions of games like we do for Hulu, right? Where you can pay 10 bucks for the game or you can pay 12 and then there's no ads. And I know that y'all are going to disagree with me, but this is a precedent that has been set, right? It happens with streaming services, and now it's starting to happen with games. And don't get me wrong, I'm not in favor of it. I'm just saying that it's a precedent that has been set.
Sure. I mean, it's one of those where, in many ways, you'll see a precedent, and then it just gets adopted into other things. Just like you're saying, that you've got... that it's happening in streaming services. Should it be happening? I mean, should is always a hard question to answer definitively because, you know, should, we're bringing in some kind of a moral judgment or something of that nature to it. And, I mean, who are we to be the arbiters unless we happen to be running a podcast where we are, strictly speaking, peddling our own opinions? Then yes, Mr. Nice Guy, we get to be the moral authorities here. You come into our house and expect us not to opine on what's the right thing? You better get out that door and find some other podcast because it's coming for you. And I say no, unacceptable, not happening, I'm not allowing it. Get those ads out of the games. If you want, as a company, as a publisher, as a developer, to be supported by advertisers, cool, go that way, support yourself on the advertisements. Better yet, let me pay you money to turn those advertisements off. I've enjoyed that model of gameplay in mobile games before. I like it. I'll go with it. I'm like, but when I'm all paying you money, don't also push ads at me. I feel like this is part of the understanding, is that I'll pay you with my attention to advertisement if I'm unwilling or even unable to support you as a developer directly. But once I do, come on, guys, you know, quit trying to double dip in there. That's just my feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that people differentiated between ads and product placement, because you guys are right. What I was talking about in movies is not an ad. You're right. It is product placement. But I still stand by the Hulu example that I gave, right? I don't know that we're at the point where we can say, if I paid money, don't show me an ad. Because it happens. I mean, I don't read magazines anymore. Like, no one really reads magazines. But back in the day, I used to love Slam Magazine, basketball magazine, right? I want to read these articles. I want the cool posters, basketball stuff. It's awesome. As I'm flipping through that magazine that I paid for, there's ads in it. And so, I mean, I don't know if I agree with the premise of if I pay money, there should not be any ads. Because once again, there are ad-free versions of a lot of things, and you have to pay extra. That's just me.
I think we ought to read a couple of things from the chat. We've got some great comments here about it. A lot of this is boiling down to Moocher, Galvatron, you know, it's not free. You know, there's got to be a Piper has to be paid here at some point in time. It is interesting, though, for sure, how some streaming services, for example, can manage to do this, can manage to, you know, have you pay and then not, like, as Moocher brings up. Many people play for Netflix that they don't need to supplement it with ads. It makes you wonder, though, where the break point is. Where's the point? How many do you have paying in before you no longer need to push ads? I wonder personally about Disney Plus and how many people are paying for that, and yet the also additional payments so that the nice kids can watch Rayla and the Last Dragon. And, you know, I mean, how much more do you need on top of that to make the model viable? I don't know. That's for the bean counters.
And I feel like we've beaten this horse. Like, there's just some questions that need to be answered. I feel like our community here is pretty much all on the same side in terms of we don't like ads, right? I'll say this, and then Mac, you can have the last word if you have something you want to add. One of my biggest frustrations with ads right now is that ads do not correlate with the rating of the content. And that's the biggest thing that drives me crazy. So as I've been watching the NBA playoffs, there are constantly ads, right? As we could say there should be, right? It's sports, there's going to be ads. But I want to be able to watch the game with my kids, and every other ad is for a horror movie that's just terrifying. And so I'm sitting there just trying to watch the game, and literally every commercial break, there's just nonsense that's not good for kids, right? And so what's going to happen if we set this precedent that games can now have ads after you've paid for them? Are we going to have T-rated games, or rather E-rated games that have M-rated ads? Like, no one's policing this, and it's one of my biggest frustrations.
No, I hear you, and I hadn't even considered that, and that's a very legitimate thing.
Ooh, that's been our topic of the week.
All right, well, now we turn to Kick or Kickstart. You know what this is. We've got a Kickstarter project that we're taking a look at. We want to discuss it live here and get your feelings whether or not you think it should be kicked out of here or whether it should be kickstarted. This is a game called Sacrifier. It's by Pixelated Milk is the name of the game company. This is not their first game, not their first rodeo, and it has already smashed their $97,000 goal on Kickstarter with still 20 days to go. With respect to the question you're all asking, as Mac, how do we get in on this? How do we get a copy of the game? Your minimum buy-in price you're looking for at this point is about 24 US dollars, which winds up being 20 euros, because this is a European-based studio. They've done it in euros. So 24 US dollars. You'll get one digital copy of the game to be given to you upon release. You will be able to choose between PC, whether that's Steam, Epic, or good old games, and console, PS4, PS5, Xbox One, Series X, S, or Switch, after the campaign has ended. They are eyeing a delivery date of December 2020 on this one. Now, obviously, this is encouraging. I like that there's the option to pick, you know, which console, which digital platform you want it for. But also, the fact that it's going to be available on good old games means that there will be a DRM-free version. I know that's probably important to some of us out there. But also, Switch is very important to Mr. Nice Guy. Now, I feel like I jumped the gun here with all the facts and figures. I haven't even told you what the game is about. Well, it's a JRPG. It has pixel art, and I love that. And it has a sort of 2.5D. For those of you who aren't too familiar with the delineation there, it's a primarily two-dimensional environment with depth of fields and things like that. So there are some 3D aspects to it, but primarily it takes place, the artwork and such, in two dimensions. But those parts that they've been showing, that they show off in the Kickstarter, are actually quite delightfully done 2.5D. The backgrounds seem to contain a lot more information than the pixel art characters would make you initially think this game would have. So definitely it looks good. Also, they did, if you pledge more than 30 euros, that'll unlock a lizard cat or a frog dog companion animal, which I think just sounds delightful. Anyway, basically, it's tale as old as time. Young soldier, elite training, big struggle, much bigger than him, goes off to, you know, gets caught up in all these things. We've heard it before, right?
On a quest.
Yeah, it's not exactly bringing anything especially new to the field when it comes to the storyline. There is supposed to be, or at least they claim that there's going to be a very deep mythos and lore behind it. But, you know, at this point, all we really have is that. The combat engine is supposed to have surprising strategy and depth to it, but they're trying not to. They're being a little bit coy here. But there are elements such as real-time movement between turns, obstacles, and limit breaks style thing going on as well. And I'm not 100% sure how it's all going to come together, the real-time aspect of it and the turn-based aspect of it. But, you know, hey, that's how it goes. I think that's kind of all I want to say about this at this moment. So let us know what you guys think, kick or kick start, as we talk back and forth. Mr. Nice Guy, what are your takes?
I think it looks great. Immediately my initial thoughts are it gives me like a Project Octopath Traveler, Chrono Trigger type of vibe. It looks phenomenal, and I don't know, I didn't hear if you said it has a demo or not, and I won't steal your thunder, but I feel like with a game like this, that, like you said, it's not really bringing anything new to the table. It really needs to be polished, and so I'd like to see a demo and know that it is polished before I really would want to back something like this. But I think it's cool, and I don't think this is something we have too much of. I just think it's something that's not anything new. The artwork is gorgeous, and I like that it's a good mix of 16-bit and 2.5D. It kind of, like, treads that line, or tiptoes that line of like a Super Mario RPG, but with a little bit more polished graphics. So like the 2.5D thing, but also 16-bit. So I like that.
Yeah, me too. Now, you didn't steal my thunder. Thank you for that. I would like to see a demo. I like almost everything about this. The price point's a little higher than I would like, but I can kind of understand where they're coming from. After all, they're releasing not just for PC, but also on platforms, which means that we have, you know, which means that we basically have to pay that platform, that console tax. And as a result, maybe the price is a bit higher since they're trying to give one price for everybody. Who knows? At the end of the day, though, you know me. I need to have that proof that you can bring everything together with a playable demo. And renders are cool, and, you know, GIFs of what's going on or going to happen in the game are fine, but I really need to feel it, to try it out. And as near as I can tell, there is no playable demo as a part of this. They haven't included one in the... in the updates, they haven't included one in the FAQs, and there certainly one isn't one inside of the campaign itself. So I see no playable demo, and as much as I would like to, and I wish them well, I can't say kickstart. I have to say kick on this one, just because of that.
Yeah, I'm so on the fence with this, man. I feel like the price point should be $15. Like, to me, that's just the sweet spot for stuff that's unproven, especially if there's no demo. I feel bad about kicking it because there's really not a lot wrong with it. It looks great, but there's just not proof that it's going to be successful. So for that reason, I'm out. I do have to kick it today.
All right. I say kick. Mr. Nice Guy says kick. Moocher, on the other hand, is very much on the kickstart. He's getting solid Star Ocean vibes and loves the art style. And by goodness, do I love the art style as well. And Rolf, mostly for the art, says kickstart. So it looks like we are divided. I think it shows promise, but I just wish that the demo was there. But that has been kick or kickstart.
Cool. Well, now it's time for Nerdflex.
Woo-hoo.
A segment where you, the viewers, try to stump the hosts. Let's get to it. So if you're here live and you'd like to, post a trivia question in the chat. Has to be gaming related. Really should be multiple choice. And we'll get right into it. And we've immediately off the bat got one from Ralph. I don't know if this is serious or not. In whose hands should one leave one's luck to, according to the meaning of the name Nintendo? Okay. Heaven, destiny, past, or future? So this is a great question. In whose hands should one leave one's luck to, according to the meaning of the name Nintendo? A, heaven. B, destiny. C, the past, or D, the future. Mac, what do you think?
Wow, I mean, it's times like this that I wish I knew Japanese, because I suspect that that's there. Thanks for the question, Rolf. I'm going to have to say, I think heaven seems a little bit, it's a little bit not Nintendo-y, you know? Destiny, perhaps.
Which one's not Nintendo-y?
A. I don't think heaven is very in keeping with Nintendo. Destiny, perhaps. The past, I don't think so, but the future. So I feel like either B or D is the correct answer.
Yeah, I immediately eliminated A just because it's religious, and I just don't think that that would be the route that they would go with the name of their company. I also don't think the past, because that kind of, ironically, shows a lack of innovation. So in whose hand should you leave luck to? And I think Destiny. Like, you can't really leave your luck to the future, but you can leave your luck to Destiny. And so to me, it's B, Destiny. What do you think, Mac?
I'm with you there. I think Destiny as well. So we're going to go B, Destiny. Rolf, let us know.
Final answer.
Yeah. We've got the answer. Yeah. It's apparently leave luck to heaven. So A was the correct answer. We got this one wrong.
Who would have thought?
Now, I suppose it's entirely in keeping. Nintendo started way, way back in the day. They were printing, you know, like cards on birch, right? I mean, the religious hesitancy, the hesitancy for us to say heaven because of its religious tones, is kind of born out of our, like, you know, how Nintendo's sensibilities is right now and in the 80s, as opposed to how it was back in the 1910s when they got founded. So,
That's fair.
So, okay. Moocher's question. What was the problem with the original Pong machine in a bar? Pong machine in a bar. A, controllers got too gunked up. B, the screen kept turning off. C, there were coding errors. Or D, too many quarters jammed up the slots. I'm going to say that actually D, too many quarters. Pong was so popular that they would just not be able to remove the quarters quickly enough.
Yeah, but like, in order for that to happen, people would have had to have been like putting in multiple quarters at the same time. Like, I don't know. I'll go with you, but I don't know if that's the one I would choose. But I trust you.
Okay. Well, maybe you shouldn't. But Moocher, it looks like we're going with D. Final answer that Pong was just so popular, they could not repel quarters of that magnitude. Aha! D! We got it successfully, Mr. Nice Guy.
Wow. Good job. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
I think Mets Girl had her question in first.
I think you're right. So we'll take Mets Girls this time, and we'll try not to read Spear. We'll try not to read yours this time. You can save it for next. Mets Girl asks, what is the reward for completing the trading quest in Ori and the Will of the Wisps? Was it A, a map stone? B, a spirit bomb? That's Goku's. C, the launch ability, or D, the permanent triple jump. Mr. Nice Guy, I'm going to have to rely on you here.
Yeah, so I did play Ori and the Will of the Wisps, but I played like 10 hours of it and didn't get all the way through. And it's a phenomenal game. Like, it's one of the ones I need to get back to. It's on Game Pass. If you have Game Pass, Mac, you should get Game Pass. Hint, hint. But to me, the trading quest was optional, if I remember correctly. And so that leads me to believe that whatever you got from it was not going to be an upgrade that you had to have in order to complete the game.
Makes sense.
It's a Metroidvania. You see where I'm going with this?
I see where you're going.
So it would be something that would make the game easier, but probably not the launch ability, right? Because I believe that's required to transverse the map.
Did you already have a map from the get-go?
I believe you did.
Okay, so I think we can probably rule out map stone, because that seems a pretty, you know, basic part.
Yeah, permanent triple jump, like, that's phrased in a way that it almost sounds like it could be that. Like, it would make it easier, but you really only need a double jump. In fact, I really can't think of a Metroidvania where you get a triple jump. I can only think of Metroidvanias where you get a double jump. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
a triple jump would be nice, but a double jump but a double jump is required. And then Spirit Bomb sounds like something that you could buy. So I kind of lean towards the triple jump.
Okay. I'll go with you on that. I still haven't played Ori and the Will of the Wisps, so I'm relying on you. We are going with D. Final answer, Mets Girl. Let us know. I'm interested to see
if I'm wrong, it's going to be Spirit Bomb, but I'm pretty sure it's triple jump, permanent triple jump.
Yeah, it does make sense. I like your reasoning, though, that it's like, you know, it's got to be something that isn't.
What?
Oh, the answer was a map stone. So I guess here's the question. Maybe the map stone is something that, like, shows you where things are on the map as opposed to gives you a map. You know what I mean? Maybe the map stone, like, shows hidden item locations or something. I could see that. Well, we appreciate
it's
the offer.
It's a callback to last game. Okay.
I might have to take you up on coming over to play that, you know, and get edumacated. Thanks, everybody. I think, how did we do? We did 1 out of 3, so not too shabby. You brought the pain for sure. We appreciate it, and we hope you can come at us just as well next week.
Cool. Good work, everybody.
So now that we've completed Legally, or now that we've completed Nerdflex, it's time for a little bit of Legalese.
Legalese.
Now, you guys know I am not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. And as part of a more expansive discussion about video games, over the last several Legaleses, we've discussed stakeholders and how video games can be considered a work of art and what kinds of things developers and publishers agree to, specifically the contracts that they're signing when they make a video game. And of course, most recently in the last one, how video games are divided into products and services. Now, it's worth remembering here that the thesis of this Legalese, as well as the next several, are that the interests of game developers, game publishers, and gamers ourselves are often conflicting, and how these conflicts of interests embed themselves in the way that we enjoy our video games today. And what we're going to focus on today is all things digital. So, Mr. Nice Guy, I open with a question for you, my good man.
Yes, sir.
When do you think the first video games were distributed digitally?
That's a really good question, and I think that it's actually going to be farther back than we think. Because if I remember correctly, they used to have shareware back in the day. And those were games that you could share multiple copies with people without copyright violations. And they were originally on disc. But I'm going to guess that the first digital games lined up pretty closely with the time when the internet was made bigger. So I'm going to go 1996.
96. Solid ideas. We had bulletin board systems, you know, things like that in the 90s. So, I mean, totally possible. But that would be 1981.
Wow.
Actually.
Wow.
With GameLine, which was a dial-up modem that was cartridge-based attached to the Atari 2600 in order to rent video games. Pretty cool, huh? So, while that was the first digital distribution we really had for video games, there were plenty of attempts kind of in the same lines, right? We had things like the Sega MegaNet, which was for the Sega Genesis, right? And then we had the SNES, or the SNES adjacent broadcast Satellaview, which we talked about that at great length in episode 133 in gaming history. Very interesting. You should go back and listen. But it wasn't really, honestly, until the 2000s, or till, you know, the turn of the century, that we really got cooking with digital distribution. Naturally, it started first with mostly DLC to consoles and PC, and then eventually whole experiences being downloaded. And it does I think it makes sense. So, Mr. Nice Guy, I'm going to ask you to answer the following question from three different perspectives. So, first, I want to hear from Mr. Nice, from Nice Guy Publishing. And then I want to hear from Nice Guy Studios, the developer of the games. And then I want to hear from Mr. Nice Guy 425, the lover of video games. So here's the question.
Okay.
Can you see any advantage to digital distribution of video games? So Nice Guy Publishing.
It's cheaper. It's cheaper and it's way more accessible. As long as you have an internet connection, you can download it. You're going to be the one paying your IP, right, for using the data. But as a publisher, I don't have to make a cartridge. I don't have to make a disc. I don't have to do artwork that's not digital. I save some money as a publisher.
All right. So now as the developer, as the maker of the game, do you see any advantage to digital distribution of video games?
Same as the developer? Yeah, there's bigger profit margins.
Yeah?
Plain and simple. Yeah, we don't have to pay someone to do X, Y, and Z. We don't have to pay for distribution. Once again, it's just bigger profit margins. And ideally, whether I'm an artist, a programmer, a troubleshooter, whatever, more of the money is going into my family's pocket, right? In that situation.
Now, I will put a little asterisk there and say that I am not aware of any circumstance wherein the developer has got a bigger cut of the game in digital distribution as opposed to physical distribution. So and it's entirely possible that it might be, but I don't think that actually has been the case. Much in the same way how we're paying the same thing for a digital-only release as we were for physical releases of the same games when they launched. But I don't know, just speculation on that. But I like where your head's at, and I would like... Yeah, that's the kind of world I want to live in, though. That's where I want to be, that those savings... in production are passed on to the developer, to the people who made it.
To the little guy, right?
To the little guy. Yeah. And what about for Mr. Nice Guy 425, the lover of video games, what advantages do you see to the digital distribution?
Yeah, so as someone who loves video games, obviously preservation is not an advantage with digital, but accessibility. So, you know, people who maybe don't have access to a GameStop, but they do for some reason have a great internet connection. I don't know in what country that would be the case. But it makes it so that games are way more accessible. And Galvatron brings up a really, really good point that we should read in a minute. But I like the idea of, you know, during a pandemic, Call of Duty Warzone was released and it was all digital. And we could all hop on and we could all play it with our friends and it was free. And you don't really get free to play games from physical software. You really only get free to play games that are released digitally, right? Whether you're talking about PS Plus, whether you're talking about Epic Game Store, whether you're talking about Xbox Live, Games with Gold, whatever it is, you know, Game Pass even. Right? Game Pass would not exist if we didn't have digital distribution.
Absolutely. I agree. And I, you know, hear what people are saying. For developers, one of the big ones that I thought of, and Rolf comes with it as well, is bug fixes. With digital distribution, bug fixes are easier for the developer to push out those sorts of things. Galvatron pointing out more environmentally friendly, transportation costs are cut down, no need to subject each other to our body odors when we go to pick up the games, of course, and the like. Now, I think Mr. Nice Guy very much on the same train. It's all what you said is almost exactly what I would have said myself. And it's no wonder with all these advantages why we would move that direction. It can cut costs. It can provide unlimited copies. It can make indie distribution possible. Could Minecraft have ever happened without their ability to make their own indie distribution? No, not possible.
Not to the same extent, right?
No, I don't think you could have even gotten a publisher to take a risk on Minecraft, for example.
No, and certainly not at a $20 price point or whatever it cost when it came out.
Definitely not. So, now, I will touch on one thing that digital distribution allows at this point is it allows for unlimited copies of a video game. It's no longer tied to how many discs can be pressed, how many cartridges can be put out there. And when a video game is no longer scarce, doesn't it lose a lot of its value? I mean, as a concept, does not value depend greatly on the scarcity of a thing? And as a result, this is kind of where digital rights management, that's what DRM stands for, really comes in. Now, to be clear, though there was plenty of software piracy back in the day, I'm sure many of you guys recall the use of game manuals and code wheels in order to get into the game itself, right? But with digital distribution comes the need for a new type of piracy prevention. Now, the first DRM programs were actually developed for use in libraries, funny enough. And back in those days, they were called return on investment, ROI software. And when you get right down to it, that's kind of the more honest name. Because, you know, I mean, like the first sale doctrine of law, when you buy a product, the original seller has no say in how you resell the item or in how you use it. And while we could go down that road, we actually covered that in great detail during Legalese in episode 23 back in 2017, believe it or not. But what I'm getting at is that digital rights management is DRM's kind of a misnomer because it doesn't really protect the rights of anybody involved. It just ensures money and cash flow, so ROI, I wish we'd be honest about it. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting sidetracked here. DRM does one thing, and one thing alone, people. DRM prevents you from playing the game if conditions are not met, right? And all of this is to make sure that only those of you who paid for the game are those who get to play it. No free riders here in video game land, and this is necessary for any digitally distributed game.
Necessary. It's necessary.
But what if, nice guy publishing, there was a way for you to never have to worry about DRM, DRM checks, or software piracy ever again? Do you think that would be appealing to nice guy publishing?
I'd be all about that.
Do you think that would be, do you think Nice Guy Development would be all about that as well?
Yeah, we'd be all about that.
Yeah, you would have full control of the people who got to play for it. Power unlimited! And of course, what happens if there's ever an issue, though? One point of attack, one point of access. When it goes wrong, it all goes wrong. Have we ever been locked out before because of DRM? Like, I don't know, around holidays on the PlayStation Network or otherwise, it happens all the time.
Now, whoa. But that's not DRM. That's people hacking the network.
No. It is. It is DRM because the DRM checks rely on the network. When somebody brings down the network, the DRM doesn't work. When your power grid is off, when your internet's the DRM checks don't happen. The game does not work. When the PlayStation Network goes down...
I can't concede this point, Mac.
Okay. That's not the same to the publisher, and it's not the same to the developer, but it's the same to the consumer. It's the same to Mr. Nice Guy 425, who loves video games, wants to play his video game, but can't because the PlayStation Network is down.
Yeah, that's fair.
No matter what the
That's fair.
And this is a situation where I think this is why I wanted to get us, and I'm going to continuously do this, try to split off. We need to split off the individual people. Now, I've actually gone way over time here. But what I'm driving at is that with digital distribution, you know where we're headed. You know where the future is going. Digital only. Stream that data. Never have it on your hard drive. Never worry about that software piracy again because the pirates can never hold on to it. It slips through their fingers like water. And that's where we're headed. It has some problems. It has some advantages. The publisher in me says, yes, I want digital-only distribution. I want digital streaming. The developer in me says, meh. And the gamer in me says, hell no, I don't want that. And I feel strongly about it. We're going to have to pick this up next episode. We're going to talk about the responsibility for games, EULAs, warranties, limited products, and licenses. I apologize that we didn't have more actual court cases to bring up. We will get more of that in the future, but that's all we have time for today for Legalese here in episode 192.
And before we go, we have one last segment called What We've Been Watching and What We've Been Playing, where we talk about just that, the cool, nerdy stuff we've been into. And if you're here live, you have a job to do. Let us know in the chat what you've been watching and playing, because we're always looking for more nerdy stuff to check out. Mac, what have you been into this week?
So what have I been into? I've been reading a series of books, fantasy books called the Belgariad series. It's an older, David Eddings is the author. I think it started in the 80s or 90s. Anyway, it's a good friend said it was his favorite. So I started reading up, just started book three today. Book three of five in that series. I also, it was mentioned in Invincible, The Underwater Welder, by Jeff, Lemire. Mark mentions it when she's just like, hey, what comics should I read? He mentions The Underwater Welder. So I picked that up and I enjoyed it. What else? Oh, I've been playing, nice, at your suggestion, I've been playing Metroid Fusion on the Game Boy Advance. And I also played through Metroid Zero Mission on the Game Boy Advance as well.
So, honest thoughts on Metroid Fusion so far?
So far, I think I might be halfway through. I'm enjoying it. I like it. I really enjoy Metroid Zero Mission, though, if I'm honest.
Yeah, it's killer. It's killer.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, as far as me, so I watched the weirdest show that I've ever watched in my life. My brother's here visiting. We're hanging out. We're having a blast. He introduced me to this anime show. I'm not a big anime guy. Every time he comes over, he tries to convert me to getting into anime. And I'm okay with it, but it's just not my favorite. Mob Psycho 100. Has anyone seen this? It's literally the weirdest show I've ever watched. Like, we were laughing the whole time. It's just like a psychedelic, random Japanese cartoon. It's the weirdest show I have ever seen in my life. Shout out to Uncle Ruckus for the subscription, dude. We appreciate you. What else have I been watching? Loki. Tons of NBA basketball. Speaking of which, your boy has tickets to go to the Milwaukee Bucks game on Friday. Eastern Conference Finals. I'm so hyped. It's going to be phenomenal. And as far as what I have been playing, my brother and I wanted to go retro, and I had some money on my PlayStation account, so I bought Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 and 2 for PS5, and we played that last night. Hopped into a little bit of Battlefield 5 and been doing a lot of Switch games with the kids. I think that is it. Mac, why don't you take us home?
All right. Well, thanks everybody for coming out, for making episode 192 such a hit. It wouldn't be the same without you. Be sure to tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell everybody about Two Nerds in a Pod, 9 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Mountain Time on twitch.tv/Two Nerds in a Pod. We love you. You're awesome. Join us each week. We'll see you next time, and keep it nerdy.
I've also been playing Ratchet and Clank. I forgot to mention that. Bye.